Jake Butt, welcome to the Icebreakers podcast. I'm so excited to have you on. You've done it all, Michigan football legend, two-time All-American, two-time Big Ten, tight end of the year, former NFL player, and now you're on the sidelines covering games. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Lila. I'm excited to be here and break it down with you. And it's a good time to be a Michigan tight end. It's Friday, yes. 25th. Last night, Colston Loveland, 10th pick in the NFL draft. So I've been a big fan of Colston Loveland, and we're building some lineage in that Michigan tight end room for sure.
Yes, 100%. What did you think of the NFL draft so far and seeing the Michigan guys?
Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, gosh, we knew that Colston, Kenneth Grant, Mason Graham, we knew that there was going to be some you know, Michigan names called. I was shocked that Will Johnson slipped out of the first round. You know,
I thought
we were talking this time last year, like he was going to be a top five pick, top 10 pick. So now just knowing the way these draft rooms and front offices work, they're going to get great value because Will is a top 10 talent, but I know the injuries were a concern. So he'll get picked pretty soon tonight, I'd imagine, in the second round.
Yeah, I know. I'm excited to see where he'll end up. Let's start with Michigan. What made you choose to come here? Was it the football, the school, Ann Arbor?
Yeah, so actually I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. So I grew up in the heart of Buckeye country. I grew up a Buckeye fan, believe it or not. So I have a very unique journey. My two teams growing up were Ohio State, and then my grandfather played for Notre Dame. So I'd never imagined as a kid I was going to be a Michigan Wolverine. But how I ended up on campus was I was getting recruited. Michigan had offered me a scholarship. And I took my first visit was Notre Dame at Michigan, 2011, under the lights. It was the first game under the lights in Michigan Stadium history. It was the famous play where Denard Robinson hit Roy Rountree in the corner of the end zone. It was such an awesome game. And I think at the time it was like a record crowd, 115,000. Maybe it might have been 117,000, but it was a record crowd. And on the car ride home with my dad, we both just kind of felt and sensed the energy, how special Michigan was. And I also cared about classes. I know these guys today care about, you know, the biggest NIL check, but I was before that. So I cared about classes and academics, and Michigan really, I believe this, is the best blend of school and sports anywhere in the entire country.
Do you remember your very first game at the Big House that you played in?
Yeah, it was Michigan versus, I want to say it was Central Michigan, my freshman year. I had worked my way up the depth chart. Like when I got on campus, I graduated high school early. So I was an early enrollee. I was 17 years old, similar to like Bryce Underwood. So I was really, really young when I got on campus. And I put on like 30, 35 pounds of muscle and kind of slowly just started like climbing my way up the depth chart. I was our third string tight end. So I didn't play in the first half, didn't play in the third quarter, but we were blowing them out. And like halfway through the fourth quarter, they put me in there. And my very first play, I caught a pass. I think it was trips left, Y stick. Shane Morris was my quarterback. He was five-star, you know, we were in the same class. And I got down in my stance pre-snap, and I knew just based on like the look, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get the ball on this play. And yeah. Shane's a lefty with a cannon. He throws it with some serious pace. So all I was saying in my head was like, just catch this ball. Like, don't drop it. Don't do anything stupid. I caught it and I could have ran for another 20 yards. There was no one around me, but I just fell down right away. The moment was a little too big for me, but still a good way to kick off my career for sure.
Yeah, totally. You were a part of some pretty intense games. Which game was your favorite while you were at Michigan?
Man, there was some intense games. I think my favorite was beating Michigan State in 2016. Like that's definitely the one that comes to mind. You know, it wasn't a close one, but after what happened in 2015 with the trouble with the snap, it was my senior year. We had like a hand, foot, mouth outbreak in our locker room that week.
Really?
So a bunch of our starters were like deathly ill and sick. And it was just one of those weeks where you're like, man, this only happens when we're playing Michigan State. And going on the road to beating them stood out. But yeah, I was in a lot of close ones. You know, every year we played Ohio State, it was a close game. Unfortunately, just, you know, came up short. You know, I work for the Big Ten Network now, and they do the Big Ten Classics. And there's a bunch of games that I was a part of. Some I was on the right side. Others came up just a little bit short.
Yeah. Well, I think so far, Michigan has definitely turned the Ohio State game around.
Exactly. Exactly. Totally.
You played under Coach Harbaugh. What was it like being coached by him? And do you have any good Harbaugh stories?
Yeah. You know, he's changed, and I don't know how closely you followed it, but maybe your viewers, you know, Jim Harbaugh, when he left Michigan, was a completely different person and coach than the Jim Harbaugh that coached me. And the big reason for that was, is we were, when Jim got hired going into 2015, we were coming off a 5-7 season. We stunk, and it was really depressing because I didn't come to Michigan to be average. I really thought in my mind we were going to be competing for Big Ten titles. You know, I wanted to go to the Rose Bowl and big bowl games. And that very first spring ball, you know, Jim Harbaugh was known as a program or organization savior. He turned around Stanford. He turned around the 49ers. So the first ever spring ball was literally absurdly hard. It was by far the hardest camp I'd ever been a part of at any level. We had the famous 4-hour practices. He split the team in two, and so we just got thousands of reps. I think they did the math on it, and we got a season and a half's worth of reps just in that spring ball. But wow, there's a method to his madness. I mean, the whole idea, I think, for Jim was, He called us up after practice one day, and he's like, you know, there's 130 guys on the team. He said, guys, I think you got this. I think you have me mistaken. He's like, I don't need 130 of you. He's like, I don't even need 100 of you. Realistically, I need 30 of you. I need 11 on offense, 11 on defense, and I need some guys to play special teams. He's like, the rest of you, if you don't want to be here, if you don't want to work hard, there's the door. You can leave. And what Jim really wanted to, what he was really saying there was, I'm going to draw a line in the sand. I'm going to make everything so hard that the truth will reveal itself, because everybody says they want to play in the NFL. Everyone says they want to be an All-American, and everyone says they want to win games. Well, Jim created an environment that was so challenging that words didn't matter. You either were you were either going hard in that final hour of practice and still competing, or you gave up. And very quickly, you could tell the 40, 50, 60 guys that we were going to be able to rely on that season and going forward to win. So that part I appreciate. And there's a ton of Jim Harbaugh stories. The one that always comes to mind for me is the nervous bird. You know, he's really, when he came in, you remember him like eating beef and drinking milk. Like, he went to Chop House in town and ordered a glass of milk with dinner. So most people are ordering wine. He said, yeah, I'll take a steak and a glass of milk. And they didn't have milk, so Chop House sent like one of their waiters to go to like the Walgreens around the corner and get some whole milk for him. But Jim was super against chicken. He said chicken was the nervous bird. So one day we were eating breakfast, and you know, you go down like the runway, the training tables, and you have eggs, potatoes, bacon, da da da. Well, our nutritionist thought we should eat chicken broccoli for every meal, so there was also chicken and broccoli available for breakfast. So as we're eating breakfast, Jim Harbaugh walks in, he scoops up some eggs, he scoops up some bacon, and then he stops and he looks at the chicken, and you could see him, that like Jim Harbaugh face, he's like looking like, chicken, like what are they doing? So he walks up to the nutritionist and he said, chicken, huh? And nutritionist like, yeah, coach, it's healthy, good lean protein. He's like, you know, it's the nervous bird, right? He looked at the nutritionist and he said, I want you to do a study to see if there's any correlation between chicken consumption and mental health disease. He said, chicken is the nervous bird. I don't think we should be eating it. So that was caught us all off guard. And then it came full circle, Isla, because now he has like a chicken coup. I believe in Ann Arbor, he had a chicken coup and was raising chickens and eating their eggs. So good for Jim. Now I think he's really high and loves his chickens, but they still are the nervous bird. So that part is true.
Wow, the nervous bird. You know, that's something, that's why I like doing this, because I don't think fans of Michigan football, they would never know that Jim Harbaugh wasn't a fan of chicken.
Yeah.
So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, it's a nervous bird. It's true. It's noted. But yeah, you can look back up. Look at Jim Harbaugh's history with chickens. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I bet. What was it like for you seeing the team win a national championship in 2023?
it was so special. I was working the game, so I
you were there.
Yeah, I was there. I was able to cover, you know, the Rose Bowl victory. I was able to cover really their whole journey. It was just special, and it even going back to that 2021 season when Michigan that's really where it started. When Michigan finally beat Ohio State for the first time in the Big House, when the snow was falling, it was like a, you know, a euphoric moment. It was almost psychedelic in a sense. It was like one of the great feelings I can remember in my life. Like you got, you know, a father and a son duo with tears streaming down their eyes because Michigan fans had waited so long. And I know there was a victory in 2011, but this was different because it was Ohio State and Michigan both at their best. And it started there. And I think that's when we all collectively started to feel different about the program. Obviously, in that season, Michigan won the Big Ten title and then lost to Georgia in the playoffs. The next year, they get to the playoffs and they're playing TCU as a heavy favorite. Well, they came up short in that game. So finally, you have this special Michigan team full of veteran players. You got J.J. McCarthy, Blake Corum. You can go down the list. And to be 15-0, it was such a dominant season. To play the way they did, to dominate the way they did, to carry themselves with such class and virtue. The Alabama game in the Rose Bowl was one of the best games I've ever seen in my life. And then to cap it off against Washington, that game wasn't as intense as the Rose Bowl, or wasn't as intense as some of the other games, but you know, you can never knock a national championship victory, and just kind of was like the icing on the cake of what we knew was going to be one of the special seasons in Michigan history.
And I think another part too that some people may forget that made it so special was there was a lot of controversy around the team, around the coaching, and for them to go and do that, based off all the changes that were being made, undefeated for every single game, and win a national championship despite everything else that was going on in the media, that's pretty special.
That's a great point. And that's what made it so unique is, you know, if everyone outside the program was trying to pull the program apart, you know, it felt like the entire college football landscape was rooting
Michigan against everyone.
It was Michigan against the world, exactly. And those guys, it made them closer, though, you know. And I think what was also unique about it too, Lila, is, you know, nowadays everyone's transferring, so you don't get to watch players get recruited and develop and progress. Right. But that Michigan team was homegrown. Like J.J. McCarthy was recruited, Blake Corum was recruited, Donovan Edwards recruited, like all the Mikey Sain were still recruited.
The OGs.
And it's like I think it might be one of the last, if not the last, old school traditional college football champions.
Right. I know. Really quickly, what's your hot take with the transfer portal and everything going on with NIL? Do you think that there is going to be some benefit to these big football schools with being able to pull different players? Or do you think it could, you know, mess up some of the dynamics? Like you were just saying before, it's like that national championship, it was OGs. They went through the highs and the lows. So that win felt even more special than, oh, I just transferred here. I had a year and my year we ended up winning.
Yeah, there's good and bad. It's just like anything. There's good and bad to it. I think the good is, you know, back when I was playing, I remember going to camps and, you know, Alabama was hoarding talent. Like Alabama had 5 stars on their bench, but now the transfer portal says it kind of like has dispersed talent. It's kind of leveled the playing field because if you're a 5-star or if you're a guy that is a real player and you're not starting for a school, you're going to transfer somewhere else where you can start. I think that benefits us. It leads to a better product. It leads to more, you know, competition across the board. But then you got the whole scenario. Like, I don't know if you or your viewers followed the Nico Iamaleva, the Tennessee quarterback that recently transferred to UCLA. So when he was coming out of high school, it was historic. He got like an $8 million deal. I know Bryce Underwood reset the market, but for Nico, yes, he was the first guy that was like public. He commits to Tennessee. He was the number one quarterback in high school, 5-star, and he makes like $8 million. Well, last year, Tennessee, obviously he leads them to the college football playoffs, and you're thinking, wow, hey, Tennessee might be a team that pushes for a national title. They get their quarterback back. They got a great coach. Well, he puts his name in the transfer portal right before spring ball. And everybody's like, what is going on here? You know, Tennessee was supposed to pay him $2 million this year. Wow. He wanted more money. So he enters the transfer portal, but no one wants him. And he ends up transferring to UCLA for less than $1 million. So he made less than 50% of what he was going to get from Tennessee. And objectively, it's a worse school for quarterback development. So That's the downside of the transfer portal, is guys think that it's always a plus and that they're going to get rich. Well, that's the downside of the transfer portal, because Tennessee's worse off and he's worse off. And you just kind of hope that there's more clarity and we can kind of set firmer guidelines for the future.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think it's a great point. Like, you know, you might think, oh, I'm not playing, let me just transfer, but that's not a guarantee. You don't know what could happen. And, you know, you see it not even just with football, but with hockey, with basketball. You could be at that top program, you're not playing, you enter the transfer portal, and you end up going to a program that's maybe considered not as strong. And that's just the luck of the draw.
Right. It's, yeah, you know, there's risk to it. There's benefit to it. I'm happy for the guys too. I wish I was around for the NIL era, because with my last name and playing tight end, I would have been, gosh, I would have been a multimillionaire by now. But I'm just happy for the guys that, you know, they're making their money right now. So good for them.
Yes. One of the biggest questions I always get is, after you graduate and you become an alum, do you still stay in touch with your former teammates?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I love those guys. I roomed with five or six of my teammates, guys from my recruiting class. We still have a group chat to this day. Don't get to see each other as often. That's kind of the tough part about, you know, aging, I guess. But it's, the conversations have changed, you know, from just like messing around with each other and living freely in college. Now everybody's married and most of my buddies have kids. But yeah, I mean, I got married last year at my wedding. A bunch of my old teammates were there. That was great. So I have my immediate circle, but for the most part, I get to see these guys. And that's a benefit of what I do in my industry, because I get to go back to Ann Arbor a few times a year to call games and watch practice, and always run into teammates there. So I love those guys, and lucky to still have them as friends.
Yeah. And then what about building relationships with the current team? Are you able to come back and connect with them too, even though you're not playing with them?
Yeah, it's a different relationship and it's a different type of connection. But it's still that respect. I mean, football's a brotherhood. It's almost like its own frat in that sense. So still connect those guys and still, you know, follow closely, and especially the tight ends. Like, I'm always rooting for those guys. It was so cool to see Colston, you know, come up and develop and have the career he did, and excited for the future with, you know, Marlon Klein and maybe a Hogan Hansen could have a special year this year. Max Bredesen's obviously a beast. So yeah, it's a little bit of a different relationship. I guess I am that old guy, that retired guy now, but still respect and brotherhood.
Yeah. You tore your ACL in the Orange Bowl right before the draft. A lot of guys now choose to opt out of bowl games. Looking back, do you still feel like you made the right decision to play?
Yeah. You know, from a financial standpoint, it definitely cost me money. You know, from a career standpoint, you know, that was my second ACL, and then I kept getting injured in the NFL, and it's probably related. But for me, it was simple that I was voted captain by my teammates. That was really the biggest game of my career. It was the last opportunity to play for Michigan. It was a New Year's Six Bowl against Florida State. That was a huge game, and I really wanted to go out there and lead my team to victory and put a real strong stamp and bow on my career at Michigan. So I would never go back and change it. That's what I always say. I would never go back and change it. But was it the best decision? I guess it depends how you look at it, because definitely cost me some money.
Right. Well, that injury didn't stop you. In 2016, you won the Mackey Award for the best tight end in the country. What did that moment mean to you?
That was amazing. I go back to when I was a recruit, you know, and I went to that visit, Notre Dame, Michigan under the lights. Have you been to Schembechler Hall? Have you seen the Michigan Museum in there? Yeah. So, you know that feeling you get, like the rich history. Like that's what I was so attracted to Michigan as a recruit, is just this rich history over a century of great players and great teams. And, you know, you close your eyes and you think about what the future could hold. And I felt like I had a chance to be a special player, and I wanted to be a part of that history. So winning the Mackey, yes, and that's part of history, right? I'm the only Mackey Award winner in the history of Michigan. I'm a two-time All-American, and the list is very, very small there. Like, there's less than 30 total guys ever to be a two-time All-American. So my jersey's hanging up in the museum, and that's really, really special. You know, hopefully I'll become a father one day and I'll get to take my kids to the museum and they'll get to see that.
Yeah, no, 100%. And you should be so proud of that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's cool.
Outside of football, what did you love most about being a Michigan student?
Ann Arbor is a special town. I think first off is just the community. Just campus, the people, just being a part of the Michigan family. My friends, for sure. But that's kind of intertwined with football. It's really just the relationships and the community and just being a part of campus. I love Ann Arbor. It's like going to your like grandmother's house when you're, you know, a little kid. It gives you that same feeling, those butterflies, that excitement. And I still get that to this day, you know, even being back last week for the spring game, I still get that same feeling going back on campus.
Yeah, no, totally. It's a special place. Do you have a go-to restaurant whenever you're here that you have to go to?
I'll give you, a few come to mind. Black Pearl, Main Street's got some great, great locations. Black Pearl, Sava's, been to Sava's?
Oh, yeah, I love Sava's.
Yeah, Sava's. Chop House is just a trusty,
it's a staple,
tasty, great steakhouse. Yeah, it's a staple. And then some of those ice cream spots. What are those ice cream spots over there by
Oh, you got Blank Slate, you got Michigan Creamery.
Both of them. I love
Washington Dairy. Oh,
yeah, both of them. Yes. You ever go to Benny's, the diner? That's my classic breakfast spot. Yeah.
It's over
by the bowling alley.
Okay. Yeah. All right, I'll add that to my list. I know we have Jagged Fork and Stray Hen.
Okay. But this is different. This is like a diner. You're describing is like a breakfast spot. I like diners, though. I like the coffee. Yes. And I like the owner. So, yeah.
Okay. I'll try it.
Check it out.
You still ended up getting drafted by the Broncos after your injury. What was draft day like for you?
The whole weekend was a mix of emotions. You know, the moment you're drafted, it's excitement. But for me, especially with the injury, I thought I had a chance to be a first rounder. So it's tough to, you know, realize that wasn't going to happen. And then round two, round three, I thought there was a chance maybe I could get drafted in round three, but that obviously didn't work out. So it comes and it goes. And seeing all the tight ends get drafted ahead of me was like a repeated knife stabbing into my heart. Just like, damn, that could have been me, you know, but you never want to think like that. And then ultimately, when I did get drafted on day three, Saturday, Darren Revelle, who's like a financial expert on Twitter, he was doing like a live count. I got an insurance policy, so I was able to collect on my injury because I dropped in the draft. I had an insurance policy that was going to pay me as far as I dropped in the draft. And I don't know how Darren Revelle found this out or got this information, but he was doing like a live tweet of how much money I was going to make in that moment from the insurance policy. So that was kind of a unique part of draft day for sure.
Yeah. Do you think you were a good pick for where you were taken? Be honest.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I thought I had a chance to be the steal of the draft, you know, and I missed my whole rookie year. And when I came back and I was playing, like I was balling and I was fully expecting to put that injury behind me. And I only played three games, but I was on pace at that time to break all the rookie receiving records. So for Denver. So I know I could have played in the league. And if you can get a starting quality, like high value, high quality starter in the fifth round, that is a great pick. So objectively, it was a great pick. It just, there's nothing we could do about the injuries. Elway couldn't have predicted that. The Broncos couldn't have, and I certainly didn't expect it either.
Yeah. With the NFL being brutal and the injuries you were facing during your time there and prior to even getting there, how did all of that affect your mental health?
That's what we talked about at the Sack the Stigma event is,
yeah,
it was a serious awakening. I'm a bit ashamed to admit, like, I was the guy that said, oh, you're depressed, like, pick yourself up and go, like, oh, you're anxious, like, that's not real. I doubted how serious it was until I was faced with it myself. And that was a serious, serious awakening. And now I try to, speak on it and help when I can, where I can with others. But it's, there's good things that come from adversity. What I've learned is every moment of adversity, every period of like great challenge in my life, I've come out the other side better and stronger. So I really do believe that. And I do think there's positive to tough times.
Yeah. Did you feel like you had support from the league, or were you kind of on your own to figure it out?
Yeah, no, you ton of support from my agent, ton of support from the NFL, ton of support from the Denver Broncos. But a lot of it really is an internal journey. Like, this is stuff you have to kind of be curious. You got to kind of seek out answers for yourself too. And there's therapists and stuff, people to help you. But, I read a ton of books. Some of it's trial and error. Like, you got to try different things and see what works for you. So I got into meditation. I still meditate to this day. Like, there's an example. If I never got injured, I would never meditate. But because I got injured and because I went through this stuff, I read a book, learned about meditation. And to this day, it's one of the great tools I use in my day-to-day life. So, I have plenty of tools, plenty of resources, but it's about doing the work for sure.
Yeah. At what point did you know or realize that it was time to step away from football?
Yeah, it's one of those things where you never, as a competitor, I don't think you ever like fully accept it and say it and believe it. But as the injuries started to pile up, like year three in the NFL, after I tore my third ACL, got cleared, and then 2 days after being cleared, retore both my meniscus. That was a tough year. I wanted to retire and I almost tried to retire. But the Broncos were like, listen, no, like, we believe in you. You're a good player. Like, just rehab and get yourself healthy. You'll come back. And I'm glad I did, because I did come back and I did make the team the following year. I went from like last on the depth chart to our, starting Y tight end alongside Noah Fant. And then I got injured week one, and then I got re-injured week three and missed the whole other year. And that's kind of when, you're just faced with the reality of like, wow, I'm the guy that is injured all the time. And that just wasn't my identity. The Bears gave me a chance. I went to a camp tryout, got signed on to them, but I just was injured that entire off season. And it's tough to admit. I was late and hesitant to admit it before ultimately, I told the Bears, like, hey, listen, give my roster spot to someone else, because, I'm not healthy and I'm not going to make it through camp. So it's tough to admit that, though, as a competitor.
Yeah. And, kind of like going off of this, we talked about it, or you talked about it back in April at the Sack the Sigma event and identity. After stepping away from football, which had been your entire life for so many years, what was it like adjusting to this new identity of no longer being a football player?
Yeah, it was tough, and it took some time. And for a while, like, I was like, I resented football. I when you meet people as a player, there's like joy for others. When I was playing at Michigan, it's, hey, here's Jake Butt, the football player. He's an All-American. He's a Mackey Award winner. And people get excited and think that's cool. I know better now. You shouldn't cling to that, because that's not good. But it does feel good. It's like kind of like intoxicating. So I enjoyed that piece of it. the same thing in the NFL. And then when you retire, there's this period of people don't even know how to introduce you. It's, hey, it's Jake, but he's the NFL. Oh, no, he's not playing anymore. He just retired. Yeah, so there's that period. Or I'd meet people and they'd like feel sorry for me. And God, I hated that part too. I hated when people would feel sorry for me. So there's that period of transition. And I would journal and I say, I have to reinvent myself. You know, I have to reinvent myself. And I knew it was going to take time, but you know, thankfully I stuck with it and really enjoy what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, what's been the biggest surprise seeing the media side of sports compared to being a player? What has that been like for you?
There's a lot of similarities. The preparation is similar of like watching film and studying and, you know, do it like learning what you need to learn to be prepared for games. It is as close to playing as possible without actually playing. And I think the biggest exciting, the most exciting part about what I do is what I love about football would be when it's 3rd and 7 in the fourth quarter of a close game and team needs someone to make a play. And I would sit in the huddle and pray that they would call my number so I could be the guy to get the target, to make the play, to, you know, just that feeling is something. It's the best feeling in the world to hear the crowd cheer, to have your team count on you. And it's this high pressure moment that leads to that. Well, in the booth, it's different, but it's the same because you prepare. You're on live TV and it's my voice talking to 2 million people. So there's no room for error. I have to perform. And that pressure and then execution is very similar to making a play in the game. So that's the part that's a parallel to playing that is the best part about what I do is the pressure that goes into it. But then when you're prepared and you execute, the feeling you get from having the good call.
Yeah, no, 100%. And has it been fun being able to be back, you know, focusing on college football, even though you can't play anymore? Has it kind of helped fill that void a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good point. And I completely agree with you and resonate with that for sure. There is a void because like football is everything. It's everything I knew. It was a large part of my day. It's what I spent every day thinking about, even when I wasn't doing it. So I was wondering like, gosh, if I didn't get into this career, like what would I do? Like what would my relationship with football look like? And thankfully I didn't really have to reinvent it. So it still fills that void. And like my work is, I get to talk to the coach. I get to go to coach meetings and talk to the players and the staff and talk about the things that I love to talk about on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, no, 100%. You recently got married. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How has being married changed your outlook on life?
It's motivating for sure. And my wife was a lacrosse player at Michigan. So she's an athlete. She's part of Team One. You should get her on here, honestly. Team One, first ever women's lacrosse team in Michigan history. So she's a pioneer. It just changes your outlook. Like, and I want to be a father one day. So it's motivating when you have people that rely on you and count on you. So I'm always a hardworking guy and I'm going to be prepared and do my job. But when you have other people counting on you, it just kind of turns that up a notch.
Yeah, no, totally. All right. Be honest. How involved were you in the wedding planning? Or did you just nod and say, it looks great?
What would your guess be on a scale of 0 to 100%?
I'm going to say you just nodded and say it looks great.
That's a good guess. Exactly. Yes. I was about 0%. trying to think. I said, as long as we have an open bar, we had a great band. The location was phenomenal. We had espresso martinis. So that was a key. That's a big key. So after the ceremony, we made sure there was espresso martinis. After the big heavy dinner, there was espresso martinis. So that's all I cared about. I didn't, nothing else mattered to me. And Natalie did the rest. And so did my mother-in-law, Alicia. She was great as well. So I got great women in my life. I got great women. Shout out to the women in my life. Natalie, her mom, my
love
mom,
that.
Her grandmothers, yes. Her Nana. They're great. They did all the heavy lifting. For me, it was like, holy, it was like a surprise. It was awesome for me. I walked in and I had no idea what to expect, which was exciting.
Maybe we should have put that in. We don't want other men to be like, oh, the surprise of the wedding.
No. Today, Natalie says it too. They joke with me about it. So it was great. And yeah, I did my part. I did my role.
How has your wife supported you during this new chapter?
Man, like, I don't even know how to like put it into words or really summarize it. Honestly, it's just like she's always there, and she's like, you know, some people, you know, it's a cheesy metaphor to call your significant other your rock. You know what I mean? Everybody that kind of gets overused, but like that's really Natalie. Like she's supported me. She's honest with me. I share my goals with her about what I want to do in life and who I want to be. And she holds me to that standard, which is just great. So yeah, she's everything I could, you know, want and ask for. So I'm lucky to have her.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm sure she's lucky to have you too.
Yeah, I think so. Sometimes, for sure.
I want to circle back really quickly to mental health. You've talked openly about your mental health and life after football. Why was it important for you to share that side of your story?
I think number one is, you know, the stigma, which is if football players who are supposed to be like big and strong and tough, and if you're in the NFL or even college, you are going to have an appearance like you got everything figured out, you know? So externally, football players should be the last people to talk about mental health. But if I could be open about my journey and some of the things I've struggled with, then I think it helps communicate to younger kids and other people that, hey, if a football player is going through it, then I should feel no shame for feeling it myself. You know, it's just part of the human experience. And the other thing is when I was really struggling after I retired and I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I was in a really dark place mentally, I journaled that, hey, I believed that I was going to pull myself out of that hole. I really believed I was going to make it out to the other side. And I journaled and prayed to God. I was like, God, help me overcome this. And I promise I will help others when I do. So it's kind of a deal I made with myself and you know, something that I feel grateful for to my higher power that I want to help others.
If someone listening is going through something similar, maybe if they've had an injury or they're just feeling lost or alone, what's one piece of advice you would give them?
I think first is just don't give up. Never give up. Remind yourself, my dad would always tell me, this too shall pass. Like whatever the worst moment you have, you're going to get through it and there'll be better times ahead. And then you'll have another bad moment, okay? But you'll get through that one too, and there's better times ahead. So it's all mental. Be very careful about what thoughts you choose to identify with. If you say you're a failure, you're a failure. But if your thought is I'm a failure and you fight back and say, hey, maybe I did fail at something, or maybe I am struggling right now, but I am not a failure. I will overcome this. Reshape your thoughts. Like find a way to always make them positive and empower yourself. You don't have to be naive or lie to yourself. You know, if you're sitting on the couch all day eating potato chips, you can't say, hey, I'm in great shape. But what you can say is, hey, maybe right now I'm struggling, but I'm going to find a way to overcome this and get in shape. So I think foundationally, everything starts with our thoughts. Everything starts with the story we choose to tell ourselves. And from there, that's where the growth can happen.
Yeah. I also want to touch on, you know, nowadays we have social media. And whether you're an athlete or you're just a regular person, anything that's put on the media can be so destructive to your mental health. Have you experienced that firsthand?
Oh my gosh, yeah. And I think I said that too. One thing what's one of the best things you can do for your mental health? Delete social media. Literally delete it. It's hard for me. It's part of my career, so I can't, you know, I can't fully delete my social media. Otherwise, I would. But I often do like social media fasts, you know, like fast from social media or cleanse, where I delete them completely off my phone. And it's night and day how much better I feel mentally when I don't have Twitter or TikTok. Like, seriously. If you're going through it mentally, delete social media. Get rid of your phone. Honestly, don't your whole phone. Just put it to the side and go for a walk in nature. Breathe the fresh air. Interact with somebody. Give somebody a compliment. If you're struggling inside, here's what you do. Go compliment 10 people genuinely, and I guarantee you'll feel better about yourself. What you give is what you get. Life is a mirror. So that's the antidote. And what does social media do? The exact opposite. Social media is constantly telling you you're not doing good enough. You are less than. You need to do this, 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 and this. This is what happiness looks like. It's really toxic in that sense. So be careful. Don't let social media use you. Right now in my career, I try to use social media for me as a career and a compliment to what I'm doing and a revenue stream, but do not let social media use you. It'll chew you up and spit you out. It's really toxic.
Yeah. And I think it's so important for people to remember that the things that are said about you online are not true and they don't define you.
Doing what I do and as an athlete, everybody's got an opinion of you. Like if I dropped a pass or if I got put on my ass when I was playing, there's going to be 100 tweets out there. You know, when I got injured with the Denver Broncos, everyone, you know, this guy's a bust. Oh, look at this guy. His knees are made of glass or paper. Like, wow, we wasted a draft pick. What is wrong with this guy? Sucks. If I delete social media like that, it's really not real. It's not real. If I don't look at it and I'm not on social media to see it, as far as I'm concerned, it's literally not real. All that matters is what I choose to tell myself. But what did I just say? Be careful about the thoughts you associate with. If you're reading social media, if I was reading all those thoughts, you can imagine the place I would be in mentally. I would start to say, maybe they're right. Maybe I am a failure. Maybe I am a bust. Maybe I was a waste of money and talent. But I deleted the social media and I said, no, actually, I'm the guy that overcomes injuries. I'm the guy that's resilient. I'm going to come out the other side. You see, like, be very careful about what type of content you're consuming on social media.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think especially for people that are younger, I mean, there are people downloading social media in like middle school, fifth grade, elementary school. And I mean, I can only imagine what they must be thinking because they're not educated enough. They can't separate the two. It's so important. And I'm so happy that Sack the Stigma, especially for athletes in general, is speaking out on this because I think it's so easy, like you were saying before, for people to put out a negative tweet if you played bad or even with the draft, if they don't like a draft pick, this and that. But you have to understand that there is a person behind who you're tweeting to. And I think somebody said it, but it was like, if you can't come up to me and say it to my face, or if you don't know me well enough to like name 5 members of my family or something, then you shouldn't be commenting.
Right. Right. No,
it's so important.
When did you get your first phone?
I got my first phone and I want to say fifth grade.
Okay. See, I didn't have a phone till my freshman year of high school. I was like the last person to get a phone. And there wasn't even smartphones back then either.
You know, what's crazy is I was one of the late ones. And I remember like I didn't have Snapchat until fifth grade. And I remember I was like begging my mom, being like, I'm the only one that doesn't have it. Like, I'm the weirdo. I'm left out. And that was it's crazy. I mean, I can only think now.
Are you glad you didn't have it?
Now I'm glad looking back on it now, I'm so glad. But in that moment, as a little kid, it was horrible. I was like, why are you doing this to me? Like, I'm the odd man out. Like, everybody's going to think I'm weird. I'm missing out. I don't have a phone. I don't have Snapchat. But looking back on it now, I'm like, I wish I didn't have a phone until high school.
Right. Right. No, I mean, that's exactly how I feel. It's kind of what we're talking about. And like I said, like when I have kids one day, I don't want them to have a phone. I'm going to hold off as long as possible. So freaking toxic though. And this is better than social media, like talking to your fellow human beings, like getting to know people. That's much more fulfilling than doom scrolling on, TikTok or Instagram.
Yeah, it's like what my mom would say. She was, you know, you either walk to your friend's house or you pick up the home phone and you call them. Those were the two options we had. There was no social media.
We don't even have home phones these days, which is crazy.
I know. All right. Well, to wrap things up, if you could play one more game in the Big House, who would it be against?
Ohio State. I would love to have one more chance at them. Gosh, I think there's like an NCAA. There's a lawsuit coming out right now. Some people are trying to sue because right now you only have 4 years of eligibility, or you could redshirt, you know. And I think there's there's a case coming out that's trying to eliminate that, which means unlimited years in college. And I might honestly have to train to come back to Michigan so I can have a chance to beat Ohio State again. But that's an easy choice for me.
Who are some of the guys you're bringing back with you for that game?
Ben Gideon, Henry Poggi. We'll put him in a fullback and try to light somebody up. Shane Morris, we got to give him back. Chris Fox, we're going to heal up his knees. He's going to come back. Chris Wormley, my co-captain. Honestly, I'll tell you everyone from my team. Jordan Lewis,
the whole team.
All those guys. Yeah, I don't want to say more names because I'm going to miss somebody and single them out. Everybody from my 2016 team.
Yes. All right. Well, Jake Butt, thank you so much for coming on the Icebreakers podcast and for sharing your story.
Thanks, Lila. Appreciate you having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow Icebreakers on Instagram and TikTok at the Icebreakers podcast to catch all the latest updates and get exclusive behind the scenes looks from each interview. Share it with your friends and stay tuned for the next episode. Until next time, go blue.